Nina, let's get a sample of your voice. We'll try to forget this little thing here and just talk as naturally as possible, because this is just to be a conversation. Would you just, for the record, give us your name?
George W. Hodges.
And where were you born?
I was born in the little town of Greenville, Georgia, which is 58 miles southwest of the city of Atlanta.
As I was saying a few minutes ago, we're interested in the your memories of the old people that you knew when you were a little boy. As I said, they were the raw material from which you developed your novel, and we want to get back to that raw material, back to the people that you remember and what you remember about them. So just go ahead, start with anything that you can remember.
Well, I thank you very much, and I might say it is certainly a pleasure for me to be here to talk with you this morning. And I might say that I have numerous friendships with groups of children. We always seem to have a good time together. So I shall be right at home, and I hope you will. And I'm just thinking that when I get away, somebody will say, "Oh, there was a question I wanted to ask. I don't want you to do that. Stop me between words, not between sentences, if you want to, and ask any question that comes into your mind." Now first, I want to take you back a long way. Some of these things I have known about, and some of these things my father told me around the home fires, like I do with Janice sometimes when we're together. And they grew on to me. I want to first see if I can paint a picture for you. If you can imagine a wide open country with here and there what you call a big house. That is where the wealthy white people lived. Around it, several little tenement houses, four of them might well sit in this room. That was where the Negroes lived who worked on the farm. Out beyond that, you had the barns where the animals were kept. You had the chicken yard, had a big garden, and in this garden they grew all kinds of vegetables. And you'd see great mounds. You'd wonder what those mounds were. But if you should go close to the mound, you'd find a little opening, and you'd often see a little child crawling into that opening. And when he backed out, he'd bring his arms full of either sweet potatoes or turnips. That's how they stored them for the year. Further over, you would see a big arbor of pine brush, almost as big as this room. And under that, you'd find plants, collard greens. Most of you don't know about them, I know. Somebody's bowing. They would take them out of the ground and put them right close together and put dirt around them, and then put this pine straw over them, the pine tops over them, and they would stay there through the year. And the next year they removed the pine brush, and the little shoots would come out. And that is what they would eat for greens until the newly planted crop was started. Now that is a neighborhood. That developed back, that was the slavery system. And during the slavery days, these people naturally got no money. They got their feed and everything. Now, the important people around the house was, first, Nana. Nana was a woman that took care of the children. Maybe she was a cook, but she had charge of the children. And if the parents asked the children to do something and they didn't do it, they say, I'll tell Nana on you. And that was the end of it. Next was the coachman. He drove the boys about. And next was the teamster. The teamster was the man who could be trusted to take cotton 60 miles away to the market. And when it was time to take this cotton to the market, they didn't sell it. They load three or four wagons, three or four neighborhoods, and these four wagons would get together, the men on the wagons, all driving four mules, and they had long whips that they popped to urge the mules on. And they would drive, and behind that came what they called the chuck wagon. That was a wagon that had the food. Well, now when night came, they would tent down, they'd cook their food and sleep there, and the next morning they would go on to the village and put the cotton in the warehouse, and then they'd return home. Well, now, when they were coming, they were proud of their whips, of course. They'd get near the town, they'd take these whips and start cracking, and the white children would hear it. So they'd run from street to street and yell, the black crackers are coming, the black crackers are coming. And as they drove through the street, they knew the children liked it. They'd take delight in cracking those whips. And on their way back, the children would follow them to the edge of town. The black crackers are leaving. So when you hear the term cracker used in the South, it refers to white people now. But it began from those Negro cotton drivers. Now, back home in the fields, there was a chuck wagon there. The slaves ate their food out in the yard in the morning if the weather was clear. They went to the field. About 11 o'clock, the chuck wagon would leave with the food and go to the field. Dinner was served there. And they would eat dinner, and they'd have their supper at night. Now that's the way you got away from there. Now comes freedom. These people are free. They have nothing to do. They have no money. And they are living as best they can. And in this particular community, the Methodist Church, through its mission society, establish what they call the Freedmen's Bureau. That is a bureau for the education of the freedmen. So they went to this town. They found there was an abandoned farm. And they went out there and bought this farm. They would sell Negroes a lot, an acre for $10. He had a whole year to pay it. He had no house. Two of them would get together and they'd go into the woods, cut poles, put them on their shoulders and bring them down to where they were going to build a cabin. And then they'd build this log cabin until they got it up above their heads. And then they'd lay logs across it. And when they laid the logs across it, they'd get grass, put it on top of that, and then put a layer of mud on the grass and another layer of grass, and they had their roof. Now as for cooking, that had to be seen after. They built a chimney, and they built of stick and dirt, just boards laid over dirt, and they would hang a pail across there and make a fire under it. And they had what they called a spider. That is a round skillet that stood on three legs about that high. And they could cook anything in that. During my time, I have known those old-time cooks to make cakes for parties for the richest people in the towns on that very thing. They cook meats and everything right there. And I want to turn aside and tell you boys something you may do one of these days. They had another way. They'd go out hunting, and they, suppose they killed a duck, they'd be hungry. Now what are they going to do about this? One of them would go and dig a hole in the ground and make a fire. The other would take this duck down to the stream and just rub mud all over it until he had nothing but a big mud ball. No feathers have been taken off by anything. Then you take this duck and put him down in this hole, cover him over with fire or embers and go on about your business. 2 or 3 hours from that, you come back, take it out, and you do what they call cracking out. That is, you crack it. When you crack it open, every feather, every single one, comes right off. Cleaner than you could ever pick one. Then you cut it open, take the entrails out, put on some salt, and proceed to eat. Now you're looking hungry right away. Now, that was that system of livelihood. All of these things happened. Now, I want to talk a minute about Swamp Angel. And Mr. Studer, many a person has said, I thought Reggie was the main character in this book, but Reggie is not. It is Swamp Angel. Swamp Angel couldn't read nor write. But he wasn't what you would call an ignorant man. He would go to these church conventions and listen. And he retained so much of what he had heard. He got to the place where he could quote the Bible. So many, many passages. And he worked in the town for both the Methodist minister and the Baptist minister. You know, Booker T. Washington said, anytime you see Negroes who are not Methodists or Baptists, some white person had been tampering with that religion. But at that time, Baptists and Methodists were practically the religions. And in the town, you'd find those two ministers. So that he worked for both, and they would talk about the Bible and things like that. And he would learn from them. And the little white children loved him, and they would tell him all these stories. And he was just wishing that his grandson could be like that. If his grandson could just read. His daughter, lost her husband in the Spanish-American War. Left her with this boy, and he set out to help that boy through college. And here's where they had this terrible time. They decided to send him 1 year. The boll weevils got all of the cotton. They couldn't send him. They had to struggle through for the next year, and when they were ready to go, they didn't have the money. And they had to borrow some of the money for him to get away. Then there was the jealousy among the colored people. If this is good enough for us, it's good enough for him. And he struggled to get him through. And the way he did it, he was a thresher. He worked on a thresh, and he worked around the yards. And he was the driver of oxen. And at the time I knew him, he was an old man, and they had been threshing wheat. They were trying to get through, and they came to a wet, muddy hill, and he took his team on up, but there was a driver behind him who didn't know much about driving oxen. Now I want to tell you about an ox team. You didn't hitch them like you hitch horses. Oxen had a yoke that came over their neck and a bowl that came down under. that was fastened into something that you call a tongue, and they pull against this. Well, now they got to this hill. They had these four oxen, and this green driver had gotten the oxen so upset that they just weren't going to pull. They were shaking their heads and stamping their feet. So the superintendent ran ahead and told Swamp Angel to bring a snap team back. Now I wonder if the boys know what a snap team is. That's a team that you just snap in front of the main team to help pull them over a rough place. Swamp Angel yelled back, "You don't need any snap team. All you need is a driver." So he came walking back with his whip. And when he got back, he saw the condition of the oxen. He just walked up to the front ones and began to shake them like that. "What's the matter with you, Buck? You're going to let me down like this? We're almost through. And you, Brandy, I'm ashamed of you. You've never done this before." "Say, Brindle, are you into this too?" "Nah, you know better than that. Come on, Baldy. Baldy, can't you get me out of here? And here's my wheel horses." That is the oldest team that he has. He put them back to the cart, and they called him the wheel horses. He said, "Nah, I'm Brandy and Jerry." He said, "You've never done me like this before." And he reached down and get his chin and pulled it up. Said, "Look at me." Say, "You can't do that." Well, now the oxen are all quiet now. They're breathing easy. He said, "Men," he called them men. He said, "Men, we are going out of here. Say, blow a little and get yourself ready and let's go." Well, now they're all standing quietly. Then he would begin to intone, I can't say it just like him, but it's something like this. "Now, get down, men. Get down, men. Come down, men." Well, now the wheel horses, the old one, they go down on their front knees at once. "Come down, Buck. Come down, Jerry. Come down, boys." Slowly they go down. And by and by, this front team would go down. Now they're all on their knees, their front knees. They're ready to pull. That is the way trained ox teams move a heavy load. Then he walked back out in front of them and turned to them and threw this whip in the air and snapped it so that it sounded like a rifle and said, "Let's go, men!" And he turned around and began to walk and doesn't even look around. And these six oxen made a lunge, and you could hear the wagon rattle, and they started on up that hill following him. And every so often he just yelled, "Come on, men," not even looking back. And when he got them to the top of the hill, he said, "Hold it, men." Just walked right back and got on his cart, and he was driving the engine, the carried the engine. They were going from one farm to another. And he blew his whistle three times. That meant all clear. We'll soon be at the next farm. And he was a man who could do such things as that. And he had a friend that they called him King's Highway. Now, King's Highway was not, that wasn't his name at all. But I want to tell you a story about how he got that name. The people were very emotional in those days. They had what they called revival meetings. And I happened to be at the church that night. The theme was, "And there shall be a highway thrown up in the wilderness, and only the pure in heart shall walk thereon. No lion shall be there, and no ravenous beast shall come upon it." And they had this experience meeting, and naturally, everybody began by saying, "I praise the Lord because I'm walking on the King's Highway." And eventually the meeting got very warm, and King's Highway and Swamp Angel were sitting in the altar. And King's Highway decided that he wanted to talk. And of course they have the communion rails around the Methodist churches, about something like a 2x4. And as he started to tell how he was walking up the King's Highway, he wanted to demonstrate. So he got up on this 2x4 to demonstrate and was doing very well, but he got so happy he was going to run up the King's Highway. And then it happened. His foot slipped and he fell sprawling right out in the middle of the floor. Well, from then on, he was called King's Highway. Now, there is something else to show the ingenuity of these people. They go fishing. As I say, they had no money. They depended on hunting. They had no refrigeration. If they killed 6 rabbits today, they had to eat 6 rabbits by tomorrow night. So they'd go fishing. Now in the winter, they could hang them on the outside and keep them a little longer. But in the summer, the food had to be eaten, had to be done away with. So when they went fishing, they'd go at night. They'd come back, clean the fish, go out in the backyard. They had these big black pots. Has anybody seen the large kettles? I have one up to the farm. They had them at every farmhouse. They used to use them, call them wash pots. Well, they would take this pot, put some cloth on the ground, pour water on it, lay the fish on top of this, and turn this pot right over on it. And that will keep meat fresh one night, regardless of the temperature. And they knew that. So it was by these devious ways. And now, lastly, before I leave it to you to ask questions, I want to tell you about this. Concerning Swamp Angel, I knew that I wouldn't have time, but I wanted to bring several letters down. So many people have written me and said, I knew Swamp Angel. There was a man just like that in my neighborhood. And others say, I knew him, said it is a better history than could have been written. So that the story of how this man worked to put his son, his grandson, through college is a story that is applicable to any community in the South. Those were the boys who went to college, worked their way through, and took their place as leaders in the nation. And I can call a number that you would know now. And principally among them, Lester Granger of the National Urban League, James Weldon Johnson, who used to be with the NAACP, and dozens of others whom I could name.
Incidentally, now, we played the record of James Weldon Johnson's creation.
Oh yes, that's right. He lived, in fact, he graduated from Atlanta University, the same school that I graduated from before I came to Columbia. And after his graduation, he went out into the country to teach in just such a place as I'm speaking of now. And it is there that he conceived the idea of this. Now for the questions from anybody.
While people are thinking of questions, could I ask this? Was Swamp Angel himself a slave at one time?
Yes.
Did he ever tell you anything about slave days?
Oh yes. Now Swamp Angel came up as a farm workman. He could pull more fodder than anybody there. There they had the corn, and in those days they would have to strip the blades off and tie it in bundles, and that's what they used for forage. And the corn was left on to ripen, and they turned that into grain, into meal. You know, meal was quite a food staple in those days. He could cut more wood than anybody else. He could handle the animals. If they brought in a rough mule, they said, give him the Swamp Angel. He'll take care of it. And then, after freedom, they retained him as a general workman around the town. He just worked for anybody around the town who needed work. And they called him all kinds of names. And incidentally, how he got that name. His name was Moses Mead. But he cut ditches through swamps. And as he was working off alone, I guess, because of the loneliness, he would always sing. They hear him singing. And because they always heard the singing down in the swamp, they called him Swamp Angel. And pretty soon the name Moses Mead was forgotten. White people, his friends, would call him Angel. Some of them would call him Swamp. And the children would even call him Uncle Angel.
Now, any questions?
Yes.
What year are you born?
Well, you're 1895. Long time ago, eh?
Do you remember any of the stories that were told to children? For instance, I was just looking at a book this morning about African folk tales, and this book said that some of those characters, the animals that talked and walked, some of those stories were brought over from Africa and told to children. Was there anything like that that you remember?
Yes. Now, there's one thing that I would like to tell you about concerning those stories. They brought over the slaves from Africa, and of course they had their own folklore. And it's amazing, it was almost an education when you consider how well they knew it and how they believed in it. And when they came over, the white people saw that they had such stories. They wanted to take advantage of it. They didn't want the slaves going off the place at night. They might escape or something might happen. And so they put patrols out on the road to frighten them back. Well, now the Negroes made a corruption of the word. They call it patterol. They said a patterol will get you. They came to think that these people, they taught them that they were kind of monsters and they'd better not go out at night. If so, the patterol would get them. And they'd tell them other such superstition as if you pass a cemetery, the ghosts will get up and whip you, they'll catch you and do all of these things to you. Well, that worked out effectively, but it served as a boomerang. Nana was the most influential woman in the household. These stories got to Nana. Nana believed them. Nana told them to the white children. And the white children believed them, and pretty soon the white children were just as superstitious as the Negroes. And they are today. In the South, those things still hold today. They've never gotten over them. Now, here's a story that I heard when I was a child, one of the African stories that came over here. Said that, and they use it for a good illustration. See, over in Africa, they had an antelope they called the kudu. Meat was very scarce. The flesh-eating animals, that is the carnivorous animals, were having a hard time. And so were the natives. So these two natives got down at a watering hole and waited for the kudu to come to drink. And when the kudu eventually came, they raised up at the same time and let go of their spear, and the spears hit him on each side at the same instant. So when the kudu fell, he fell straight down. Well, they came over and an argument started. When he said he's mine, he said, no, he's mine. They said, well, if you had hit him first, he would have fallen this way. If you had hit him first, he would have fallen this way. He's right down. Well, they argued, and they argued. And they said, well, now, there's going to be a lion along here. He'll smell this blood. We better get away from here. So they walked down the path, arguing as to whose kudu it was. And by and by, they got to a certain point where the paths divided. And they stopped there to argue. And that's why I wanted to, now listen, I think I hear a lion coming. He said, well, I tell you what we'll do. He says, since we can't decide, we'll split the kudu half open. You take one half, and I'll take the other. So they split the kudu half open. This one takes his, he goes this way. This one takes his, he goes that way. And pretty soon, here came the lion as hard as he could go, roaring. And when he got there, they had just gotten out of sight. So the lion smelled this way, he said, it went that way. He smelled this way, he said, it went this way. And the lion was trying.